Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, live from the Boston Public Library and streaming to youtube.com/GBH News. Jim and Marjorie are off. I'm Jared Bowen, here with Andrea Cabral. Joining us now via Zoom is food policy analyst Corby Kummer. He's executive director of the Food and Society Policy Program at the Aspen Institute, a senior editor at The Atlantic, and a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy. Hi, Corby.
Hi, Corby.
Hey, Jared. Hi, Andrea.
So, Corby, Starbucks recently opened up a location on Belmont Street in Brockton, and they just announced that they intend to close their dining room between 1:30 p.m. and 3 o'clock p.m. on weekdays during the school year. And they specifically say it's to deter kids from leaving, Brockton High School, I guess, and other schools to the extent that there are others nearby, and hanging out there. What do you think of that?
And same thing, by the way, I saw on WBZ the other night for the McDonald's in the same neighborhood.
Right, McDonald's, I think, is locking the door and letting people in one at a time. At first, I thought, oh, they don't want the real estate of the tables occupied by kids who maybe buy one thing and then don't keep essentially paying rent money on the tables they occupy. But it seems to be something about security and worried about fighting because there have been a lot of security incidents in Brockton. They just aren't saying that publicly. I think it's the same reason for McDonald's, because there have been a lot of security incidents. The mayor of Brockton says this is a wonderful new addition to downtown. We expect them to stay open the full day during business hours. But they haven't replied. They haven't said, this is a matter of security for our team members. So it's hard to know what to make of the story.
And wait, I was just going to ask how we look at this in the context of earlier, uglier headlines about Brockton High School and calls for the National Guard to come in, which were not answered by the governor. And there were disputes about just how the circumstances were in Brockton High School, just as I think people are wondering, well, how bad can it be that these restaurants have to do this? But maybe there is evidence there. It's a delicate fine line that they have to walk here, both institutions, Starbucks and McDonald's.
Yeah. Usually they say something. That's what, so I'll go ahead, Andrew, but I'll just say that in Washington, Starbucks was one of only two vendors of coffee, and they pulled out because they said there's just too much security problems in the train station.
Well, they're going to keep the drive-through open, and I guess you can come in and walk up to the counter and you can order. But when you analyze this from a retail perspective, do you assume, like I sort of did, that they made the calculation about how much money they would be losing by closing the dining room to everybody and decided it was worth it? Is that, like, what's the analysis that goes into saying we're going to close during regular business hours?
I assume it's just plain security, or saying we don't want the tables to be hogged and our other customers don't have a chance to sit and they don't want to talk to students. But if they would actually explain themselves, it would make it easier for us to comment.
Okay.
Well, Corby, let's move on to something else that is still a little raw for me, because a couple of months ago I was actually having dinner with Jim and Marjorie, and it was made very clear to us later on during the dinner that it was time for us to go because, and this is being reported in the New York or Grub Street, I should say, as well, that more and more restaurants are starting to apply pressure because they want to turn the tables over. They want to get more cycles so they can get more revenue. But I can tell you that Jim was not very happy that night. Actually, none of us were very happy that night, because if you're going to a restaurant, you're sitting down, you're spending a fair amount of money, because it does cost a fair amount of money to dine out now. And then to be rushed out the door, it just makes the experience less fun. Where do you come down on this, knowing that restaurants are also, it's a difficult business model?
So what interested me is that a number of restaurants interviewed in this piece in Grub Street, which was started by New York Magazine, say, we need three turns, not two.
Right.
So we've got to have that third turn or else we're never going to be able to break even. It's been so hard for restaurants to figure out how to make it economically during, and then if they were able to stay open after the pandemic, how do they stay in the black? But what this article said is that it's becoming a policy that's announced when you make your reservation on Resy or another platform. So, Jared, were you, Jim, and Marjorie told when you sat down, sorry, you're going to have to be out in 90 minutes?
Well, that's what I'm trying to remember. I don't remember anything like this, but I know that there are so many things we see now, and I I didn't. I made it in person, actually. I made the reservation on in person, so I didn't see anything online about the clock starts ticking the moment you sit down and you have 90 minutes.
It's more than that. They should have told you when they sat you, when they gave you the menus, and say, we really want you to enjoy this, but we remind you, as we said when you made your reservation, we need to free this table in 90 minutes. As the Grub Street piece pointed out, all of us are used to showing up at a restaurant and begging for a table, and they're saying, yeah, we'll let you in, but there's somebody coming at 8 o'clock for that reservation. It's 6:30 or 7. That's the contract you've made verbally when you sat down. So you can't really begrudge it because you said, oh, fine, just seat us. We were hungry. Whereas you can't even remember if they told you. That's like bad management.
I have to say, I kind of feel like, you know, I don't mind if I'm asked to leave after a certain period of time, because I get the turning of the tables. And there are people that will just kind of sit there sort of interminably nursing like the last few sips of coffee. Corby, there are times when restaurants, like during a downturn time, there are restaurants that want people to stick around longer to make the place look fuller, right?
Yeah,
so it kind of cuts both ways.
There was such a good piece by Pete Wells, who after 12 years is leaving the Times, talking about not liking the automation of the check dropping and paying policy. He liked human beings, but he did start off by saying, in the 12 years I reviewed restaurants, I would estimate I spent 3 months waiting for the check. So all of us have had those interminable, how do you flag down the server? In this case, the piece was full of little tips that the servers and the management use to drop your menus fast, to get your drink order fast, to dissuade you from ordering a white wine that would require 15 minutes of chilling because they don't have 15 minutes to do it, dropping the check the minute you put your spoons down from your creme brulee. So that's all good and efficient, but it's deceptive if they don't remind you at the beginning of your meal, we do have this table booked in 90 minutes. We ask that you be gone in 90 minutes.
Yeah, it's just not fun. It's just not fun. You don't want to go and realize, okay, now I'm in a race to finish everything. It's just not fun.
I like. Can we get you anything else with that kind of like? Don't say yes. Yeah. Don't say you want anything else because they're not
as they're taking your plate away while your fork is still midway.
Whereas my spouse, who always wants to go home early, thinks this would be just the best policy ever.
Yeah. Let's now talk about Corby Cummer, Wally Amos, the founder of Famous Amos Cookies, who died recently at age 88. So at least we know he lived a full life. I don't think I realized how full a life.
Yeah.
This is a really extraordinary biography of Wally Amos. Tell us about it.
Well, first of all, it's been a bad year for premium chocolate chip cookies because David of David's Cookies died this year too. So this is Famous Amos. He was a talent agent who started in 1975 with a $25,000 loan from famous singers. You'll remind me who they are.
Helen Reddy was one of them.
Otis Redding.
That's right.
And Helen Reddy.
As a talent agent, which was really hard for an African-American to break into. And he started in 1961, really young. He built a bricks and mortar place on Sunset Boulevard. It was a huge hit. He was really good at shutting down the block for block parties and stocking his parties with celebrities through his talent agent connections. He was a tireless promoter, and he had a straw Panama hat and Hawaiian shirts before Trader Joe's had Hawaiian shirts. And he went around the country. He was really good at promoting. He wasn't so good at the bottom line. And so eventually, I think by 1988, he had to sell. He became a celebrity for himself. It was Marvin Gaye and Helen Reddy.
Oh, not
Otis
Redding. Yeah,
original
sorry.
Backers. But he couldn't keep the business running. And he became bitter. He stayed on for a year as spokesman afterward. But then he became a tireless advocate for childhood literacy because his mother had never learned to read, and he learned to read late. And he made that his signature cause. So a really admirable and interesting person.
You know, one of the things about this story, though, that made me a little bit sad was the part where they described that in 1991, he launched a new cookie venture. He called it Wally Amos Presents. But the current owners of Famous Amos sued him for trademark infringement. He tried to change the name of the company to Uncle No Name. It took 2 more years of litigation, and they finally say to him, yeah, okay, fine. You can use the Uncle Wally name, but you can't sell cookies, so he had to sell muffins. I mean, that just made me sad to see that it became so contentious, and they sued him for trademark infringement when he started this entire thing using a grandmother's recipe for these cookies.
Aunt's. But, you know, it's sadly common that people lose control of their name. And so when you sell a business that has your name on it and they say, we're going to use this in all of our trademark, you have said goodbye to your name for a long time. And so, you know, for example, the wonderful coffee roaster and pioneer George Howell, locally, he was able to use his name because Coffee Connection was his business, which he was never able to use again. But then after 10 years of a no-compete contract with Starbucks, he was able to invent something under his own name. That's the exception. It's not coming to me now, but there are many famous brands of people who completely lost control of their name.
Well, it was just nice to read also that even if he did lose the business, he still kept at it in different ways, as you say, with literacy, and then seeing his articles of clothing go into the Smithsonian and just be recognized nationally for his contributions in
Maybe
so Aiden many regards.
Maybe Aiden and Jamin can look. It might have been Mrs. Field herself of another chocolate chip
cookie. Oh, that would make sense. You know, that would make sense. And Famous Amos came before Mrs. Fields, but I think you're right. I think her name was Debbie Fields. She lost control of her name as well.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're speaking with food policy analyst, writer, Corby Cummer. Corby, there's a really devastating story that's come out. Andrea and I were talking about this before the show. Frankly,
it's awful.
It's just more of the same, but in a whole industry we didn't know about this time, but more abuses, more horrible things happening. This time, it's about the sugar industry.
So what really stood out to me, first of all, it's in India. Did I know that India was the second largest sugar producer in the world? No, I should have, but I did not. And they're forcing women to enter childhood marriages so that they can work side by side with their husbands in the field, and much worse, forcing them to have hysterectomies so that they won't have periods that keep them out of labor. A shocking 18th century, you think this is hundreds of years old, this kind of cruel practice. But also the parallels to the sharecropping system that would year after year cheat black farmers out of their actual share of the profits by turning them into indentured servants. In this case, they have to borrow from employers to get these forced hysterectomies for something like a painful period that should not have required a hysterectomy in the first place, then they're in debt. So it's advances. The whole farming system is founded on advances from the employer that then the employer makes difficult to pay back. So they become essentially indentured servants / slave. It's really shocking. The most shocking part for me was, aside from these horrendous practices, that there's a company called Bonsucro, Good Sugar, Bonsucro, that said it was guaranteeing fair labor practices and it was turning a blind eye to these hysterectomies, which it knew. And major brands like Coke, PepsiCo, Unilever, and General Mills said, you know, our producers are Bonsucro certified, so we're fine. We're not using forced labor. So the idea that the certifying agency, which is supposed to guarantee fair trade and fair treatment of labor, is itself corrupt and inattentive, is what's really scary, because it sort of raises doubt about the entire certification system.
Well, these organizations like Coca-Cola, Unilever, and General Mills, they shouldn't get off on on placing blame on this other agency and relying on their standards. Isn't it incumbent upon businesses, especially like Coca-Cola, to do their own investigation, especially in these times where we're more and more exposed to these horrific human rights abuses?
We may think so, but if they say, no, we're only contracting with, you know, like One Fair Wage and Fair Trade, those have excellent reputations, and I'm sure that they're very careful especially fair trade, about guaranteeing the conditions of work. Coffee Kits is another. I trust those brands. I trust their certification system. But, for example, Whole Foods didn't go with the Animal Welfare Institute. It decided we have our own certification. So maybe, Jared, you would prefer that because it's the company saying we take responsibility. But if they're not a third-party certifier, they don't have a lot of incentive to make all of their criteria and inspections transparent.
The part that I don't understand, and it could very well be that somehow this isn't a crime in India, is a forced medical procedure, a hysterectomy, which also means that you will not ever have children. Forced hysterectomy for the purpose of enriching the bottom line of the sugar industry or certain companies in particular. How is that not a crime? How is that not a crime somewhere? You know, I don't know. I know there's not an international criminal court that's going to look at something like this, but how is that not a crime? And why aren't they at least going after the doctors who are performing these procedures on these young girls?
We're imposing standards that we think other countries should have, and we don't know. If the doctors have a fig leaf of saying, oh, the woman was having painful periods, or they can invent some reason for a problem that caused them to say you need a hysterectomy. Forced sterilization in China and Russia. There have been so many examples, and I don't know of an international human rights court that has taken these countries to task. The New York Times was taking credit for an investigation into the sugar industry that uncovered the inattentiveness of Bonsucro, the certifying organization, in the first place, which forced a task force of Bonsucro and companies like Coca-Cola to saying, we're now keeping a more attentive eye on this, as you, Jared, think they should. But I don't know where the laws are that compel any of this fair treatment or supervision.
Well, and Coca-Cola and PepsiCo, basically their response is, well, we only buy a little bit of sugar from them. So we're kind of, we're not really responsible because it's not like we buy a lot from them, which, for Americans, we were used to pushing back on companies. Maybe that's what should be happening here, is that we should be
that
pushing
back.
That
way lies large companies. Apple was busted for forced child labor from Foxconn in Hong Kong, and it cleaned that up. Nike, all of these companies that have faced forced labor, it's in Southeast Asia, it's in other countries, and they claim not to have known. And then once an investigation brings it to light, usually they're shamed into action.
Well, I hope the shaming continues because also it was sort of another trigger there that to say task force. How many times have we heard the words blue ribbon commission or task force applied? It seems like a public relations strategy, as in we're looking into it, and how often do they do the work? So I agree with you, Andrea. Public pressure needs to be applied.
Yeah.
Well, to switch to something much lighter now, we have talked about loneliness, especially coming out of the pandemic. There are loneliness epidemics all around the world. It's considered a health, if not crisis, certainly something that very much needs to be dealt with, again, internationally. But now there's an app for that, as we see with restaurants. What's happening?
Apparently there's like 200 apps for this. First of all, we should credit our wonderful Surgeon General, Vivek Berthy, for making this a national priority and talking about loneliness as a real disease. So this is people who are tired of dating apps and actually don't want the fatigue of trying to find a romantic match, but do want to find friends, companions, especially if they move from overseas to the U.S., or they're transferred, or they've had a breakup, and they need to reconstitute their friends. This was an app that the reporter named Lisa Bonos from the Washington Post used, and she found it was the breakfast. She didn't use the breakfast. It was a lunch app, Creative Lunch Club, in which you would be matched one-to-one or with a group, which she said she would prefer, to find other people who are not in your profession. For example, Breakfast Club in Silicon Valley is deliberately for people who want to get out of the tech trenches and only find people in the tech business. In Washington, I think where this journalist was based, she was saying, I used to be a night, I had the night beat. So it was almost impossible for me to find or make new friends. I know what that's like. So the Creative Lunch Club was exactly right for her. But a woman she quotes at the end, who's the author of The Art and Science of Connection, Why Social Health is the Missing Key to Living Longer, Healthier, and Happier, said that every week she hears about a new app. And that once you're out of college, or once you're out of a way of always meeting people because you're constantly being exposed to new people, it's very hard. And what this piece didn't particularly make a thing of, it's the rise of remote work after the pandemic. In so many ways, it's preferable. But when you switch jobs, as people do much more frequently than they used to, how do you hang out with people enough to know whether you'd be interested in having them as friends or not when you're doing your laundry and cleaning your kitchen instead of going into the office?
Well, last week, Corby, we talked about the sort of decrease that restaurants are seeing in their bottom line. We talked about, you know, the barbecue place where he counts the trays, and that's kind of how he knows whether or not business is going well. This seems to me like a potential good marriage between the restaurants who need the patrons and an app. I don't know how you get on, you know, how you decide what restaurants you're going to go to, but an app that has people meeting at some of these places that need to have an increase in customers.
And maybe they can give a discount if you'll be out in 90 minutes.
See, I was just thinking for this, good. I would take 60 minutes because you don't want to be trapped for 90 minutes with somebody you just met and you
good.
Might not enjoy.
So that's a 60-minute limit.
I'm on board
that's
with this.
Excellent.
It's great to see you, Corby.
Good to see you,
great
Corby.
Great to see both of you.
Corby Kummer is the Executive Director of the Food and Society Policy Program at the Aspen Institute. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic and a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy. After a quick break, GBH's Callie Crossley is here with the latest George Santos update. You're listening to Boston Public Radio 89.7 GBH live from the BPL and streaming online at youtube.com/GBHnews.